This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, baby. Hello, Rebel baby. Hello, baby. Today.
Welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast. This is season 2, episode, let me just count it off, 5, with Tamima Anam. I've just got back from holiday and I'm feeling very much like it's my first day back at work after 2 weeks of being on holiday, which is hard for me. I've not been doing much. I reread some novels. I read some new novels. I played with my kids. I saw my dad and my sister and I ate a stupid amount of food and drank a lot of coffee and other things, and it was just glorious. Like, it was just one of those holidays that I didn't do much, and it would be boring to recount to you all the stuff that I didn't do. I guess the main thing is I'm just not very good at taking holidays. Part of me knows that a holiday is probably, for a writer brain, a bit of work anyway, because on holiday I go to new places, I observe new people, I have new conversations and overhear new conversations, and I give my brain some space to think and imagine and all the rest of it. Ah, the curse of the writer, always writing in their head. How self-aggrandizing of me to to go, oh, right, 2 weeks off was actually work. Anyway, this is why I've got such a weird intro this week, because it's my first day back after a holiday, and I haven't had a holiday since, I think, 2019. I may have taken some time off in 2020, but, like, did anyone really take any time off in 2020? Anyway, the point is, today is my first day back at my desk, and I'm looking out onto the street where I live, and autumn has finally decided to stop pretending it to be summer, like it has for so much of August, and it's grey, and there's a chill in the air, and when my alarm woke me up at 6 a.m. so I could do the yoga that I promised myself I'm going to do every single day and then somehow managed to not, it wasn't light outside, so I chose to just stay in bed and not do yoga. The point is, I'm back and it's the Brown Baby Podcast. Welcome. This is a podcast about parenting, and it asks the question, how do we raise our kids to be joyful in bleak times that make us feel so sad and angry? And each week I invite a parent on to chat to me about their parenting journeys, how they're navigating these tricky times with their kids, how we have those big important conversations with our kids, and how to still have fun and enjoy the world. I hope this is a hopeful podcast about parenting, and it's inspired by my, can you tell that I've been on holiday? I can't even say by my memoir, Brown Baby. I'm not even going to edit that out, mate. By my memoir, Brown Baby, a memoir of race, family and home, which has been out since February this year. And I love that people keep finding it and choosing to buy it when there are so many other books you could be buying, and tagging me into brilliant reviews and kind thoughts about different bits that have resonated with you. Please keep doing that. I love seeing them, even if I don't always respond. It's just nice to know that the book is finding readers. And for those of you who have not bought it yet, here is the bit where I go, please buy it. Please buy it. I said it in two different modes. One was like desperate and the other one was assured. Please buy it. Yes, so this week I talked to the incredible author Tamima Anam. Tamima is the author of 4 novels, Her most recent one is the one that we spend a lot of time talking about because it has so much crossover with her life. It's called The Startup Wife, and it is a hilarious skewering of the sexism of the tech industry. It follows Asha Ray, the inventor of a new utopian app, who soon finds herself sidelined in her own work and in her own industry and starts to wonder why. And there is a similar starting point for Tamima, who is the wife of a startup entrepreneur, and you know, found herself taking some of her own time out from her career to be a parent. And we talk about that, and she's such a brilliant, lovely, funny, warm person to talk to. So yeah, as well as the book and the inspiration behind the book and how that kind of crosses over with her parenting journey, we also talk about letting our kids use tablets. If they understand what we do for a living and the tech industry is a problem with women, it's a great, really important chat. I really love talking to Tamima. Every time our paths cross, I just think, I need to spend more time with you. Tamima's book, The Startup Wife, is out now, and you can get it from my affiliate bookshop on bookshop.org. The link is in the show notes. So yeah, just that reminder that the podcast is free. Please support it by buying my book, by buying Tamima's book, and by shouting about this podcast on social media. I'm not on there much anymore because, you know, my brain doesn't like it. And so any help in getting the word out there would just be super appreciated. Thank you so much to all of you who do that, and to those of you who are going to do that after this episode. So without further ado, season two, episode 5 of the Brown Baby Podcast, Tamima Anam. Welcome to the Brown Baby Podcast, Tamima. How are you today?
I'm well, Nikesh. Thank you so much for having me on. It's such a thrill. I love the podcast. I love your book. It's really a real pleasure for me to be here.
Oh, mate. Thank you for making the time. I know, I'm talking to you the week after The Startup Wife, your new novel, has come out. And so the fact that you've got an hour to spare where you're like, sure, I'll talk to this loser, is amazing. Thank you so much.
Not at all. And also, I think the thing to be really clear about is that things do happen when a book comes out, but it's not like that many things happen. I'm not doing things all the time. I'm mostly just sitting and feeling anxious about the book or trying to tell myself it doesn't matter. So this is really such a pleasure.
Yeah, it's funny. The advice I always give to writers is the advice I don't take myself, which is once a book comes out, it belongs to readers and it doesn't belong to you. So it's really important to just start the next thing and just go, whatever will be. And my publicist will tell me where I need to be in attendance at. And I might get a sales update when I need to and all that. But actually, the reality is I am obsessively checking everything all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, I wrote to my publicist yesterday and I said, my ego is as fragile as a Parmesan crisp. So just remember that when you're telling me anything, and don't tell me anything I can't hear.
So The Startup Wife is about so many things. It's about marriage, and it's about technology, and it's about the sort of how in those spaces women become very invisible, and about this amazing protagonist Asha coming just reclaiming herself throughout the novel. Can you just tell us a little bit about where the novel started for you?
Absolutely. And I think it's very relevant to what we're going to talk about, because this is my post-children novel. And I wrote 3 novels. I wrote a trilogy set in Bangladesh, following the lives, of women in 3 generations of a family. And I have to say, Nikesh, the body count in those books was really, really high. And I had children in a pretty traumatic way, and I just could not write about dead children anymore. And I felt viciously, violently, rejecting that mode. And as you know, as you did in your memoir, you have to go to these very, very dark places in your heart in order to bring that up. More so for you, because yours was a memoir. So I really respect that. But sometimes it's harder to go there, or it feels like my sort of dharma at that moment after I had the 2 children was to write something that was joyful. And even though there are there's politics and there's feminism and there's the invisibility of women in this novel, it's fundamentally not about pain. It's about joy. Mm. And so for me, that was like a totally different writing experience from start to finish.
Yeah. And also in contrast to that trilogy, that this feels so much sparkier. Like there's that it's really funny in places. Like you don't shy away from the kind of the absurdity of these worlds that she finds herself in. Was that part of the joy, you know, trying to push for humorous situations and bits of like tech slapstick and what have you?
Yeah. So I have been a startup wife for the last 10 years. My husband founded a tech company within months of our getting married, and I've been on the board from the beginning, and I've also worked there. And I mean, you've had office jobs before, Nikesh. I mean, there's something really amazing about going to an office, writing some emails, meeting some people, and then going home and saying, wow, I did a really good day's work. So
The problem is you've just described something that doesn't exist anymore.
It's true.
Sorry to interrupt.
But it used to exist, and it used to feel a very refreshing change from my writing life, which was full of angst and you know, never seemed to have a beginning of a day and an end of a day. So I worked at the startup, and really I just wanted to satirize that world because it is so particular. It has its own language. The language is quite metaphorical. The way people talk about business, about their products, about how they're going to change the world with some app that they've produced. And I just, for me, that was like the material was right there. And then I just had to figure out whether I could be funny. And that was a challenge.
And you are.
No, if I could pull that off. Thank you.
I mean, you are in real life, so why wouldn't you be on the page as well?
Well, you just never know. And actually, my husband said to me, because I was like, I'm feeling like, what is the connection? You know, is this me? Is this book me or are those books me? And he was like, well, in life, you're all about the comedy. So this is this voice is more like the way that you speak and the way that you are in the world. So yeah, I feel like even though Asha is born in Queens and is a New Yorker and is a coder, and in some ways her life is very different from mine, I feel like I voiced her. You know, I feel like I put a lot of myself in that character.
I'm sure I won't be the only one to make this crass comparison, so I apologize because you've probably had to deal with it a lot. But what's interesting is having watched a show like Silicon Valley, which is all about dudes in this space, and the irony of it is that the writers couldn't write decent female characters in a world where there are no, you know, these guys would not be friends with females in any ways whatsoever. And obviously, like, stuff that came out about a female cast member finding that environment really, really tough to deal with. And then you have something like this, which kind of really, really, almost, it's like a satire of the satire that is Silicon Valley, which I found really, really interesting. And also, interestingly, straight after this, I'm talking to this amazing academic called Meredith Broussard, who she was involved in this film that just came out on Netflix called Coded Reality, which is all about AI and the coded gaze. And I met her at a literature festival, and she the way she talks about sexism and racism within AI is really fascinating. And so, like, the fact that, you know, you're kind of adding a hyper visibility to the, you know, what has already been canonized as an invisibility, I thought was really, really amazing. And it's such a fun book as well. You know, it's not a book that, like, ever tries to kind of polemicize at any point. It's always like, it's very light on its feet, and I think that's why it's so powerful.
Thank you so much. You're very kind. I mean, I feel like the thing about the tech world is that it's the word disrupt is haloed in the tech world. And they're disrupting everything, like the way you order your pizza, the cars you drive, the way you do your laundry. I mean, there's like an app for everything. There's a service for everything. And they're disrupting everything. But in fact, the structures of power are completely the same. There are young white men who run these companies, who work at these companies. And although there's a lot of lip service about, you know, diversity in tech and hiring and talent and all that, it really is just as it ever was. And that is obviously going to be the case when certain kinds of people write the AI codes that are going, you know, that are going to be the artificial intelligence of the future and determining, you know, it's going to have the same biases that the people who built it already have. So yeah, and I think, you know, one of the things I created was a tech incubator called Utopia, and I purposely made Utopia have a lot of female founders in it. So there's a lot of women running tech companies, and obviously that's totally made up because you would never have a place like Utopia that was mostly run by women. That was just a fantasy of mine.
So tell me a little bit about, you know, obviously as someone who was a startup wife, and when was your last novel out? It wasn't 10 years ago. It was sooner than that.
No, it was in 2016.
So I'm so sorry. 5 years ago. So in that time, you know, you've had kids and you've been the aforementioned startup wife. And I remember you talking a little bit about feeling like you had to put your career on hold, or you had to put writing on hold for a little bit when you became a parent for the first time. And I wondered if that was something you felt comfortable talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the first thing to say is that my journey towards becoming a parent was very, very fraught. So like a lot of women, and this is something that we talk about more, but we still don't talk about enough, I had a lot of trouble having children. So I was already, by the time my son was born, I was already 37, and I had had many miscarriages. And it was an extremely challenging thing just to get pregnant and maintain the pregnancy. But then when I was 6 months pregnant, I discovered I had like life-threatening preeclampsia, which is when you have a lot of things associated with high blood pressure. So my son had to be delivered 10 weeks premature. And he spent 3 months in the special care baby unit at the Homerton Hospital in East London. And I think that was probably like the most life-changing event of my life. But it took me a long time to really understand the deep kind of wounds that had kind of, because at the time, and as you know, as a parent, you just kind of go into autopilot and you just think, okay, well, this is really, really hard, but I just have to get through it and I'll worry about myself later. I'll have a nervous breakdown in 10 years or something, but I can't afford to do it now. And anyone who's had a premature baby will know that there are certain physical kind of demands on you that you just have to rise to the occasion of. So I was very, very ill, but I had to pump breast milk because preemie babies are dependent on breast milk much more than full-term babies are, not to go into a lot of detail, but because your body is not has not had its full time to be pregnant, you're not ready to do it. So you have to really you have to basically attach yourself to a breast pump for every 2 hours around the clock, day and night, until your body says, okay, now I feel like I can do this. So it was really physically grueling. It was deeply traumatic. I felt an enormous amount of guilt because I felt like I had not been able to host this child in the way that it deserved. So I think that in any case, if I had had a full-term child who was perfectly healthy, there would have been a lot of challenges to writing, being a startup wife. My husband was traveling all the time and having children. But this was like vastly magnified by the way that the children arrived. And they were both premature, although the second one was less so. So absolutely, I felt, I mean, I wouldn't say that I put my career on hold, but I put my ability to put myself in the center of the family on hold. Mm. And I would say that I only recently, maybe with the writing of this book, felt able to reclaim that space.
Thank you so much for sharing that. And I hope it wasn't too uncomfortable sort of re-going through it. And the interesting thing about Asha in the book is her, she's the kind of character who you kind of like, I was about to say really stupid and I stopped myself. She's not a no, she's, oh no, I'm not even going to say because it's so ridiculous. I was going to...
No, please, say. So stupid. Say, you can always edit it out.
Yeah, I was going to say, she's not a nobody puts baby in the corner type.
Oh, because yes.
She would, you know, she doesn't need someone to tell people to not put her in the corner. You know, she arrives on the page for like really fully formed, and it's become so much about, you know, getting the world to realign to who she is rather than adjust herself to the world, which I think is a really interesting choice in fiction.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing about Asha is that she is so much feistier and so much more confident than I have ever been or possibly could ever be, which is, as you know, the sort of joy of writing fiction is that you can pretend to be other people momentarily and inhabit their strengths. But the thing about Asha is also that she gives all her power away to Cyrus. And so you think, oh, a person like that is never going to be subject to the same limitations that I am or that other women are. But in fact, and as he says to her at the end or towards the end, like, you know, he says, I didn't take something from you. You gave it to me. I didn't even want it. You know, so basically she builds this app. It becomes super famous and she makes him the CEO and she kind of hides in the background. But she does that. You know, he doesn't want to be at the front. But of course, once she gives him the power, he absolutely takes it and runs with it and becomes a bit of a megalomaniac. But I think to me, that's the interesting thing about women in power, which is that often it's not necessary. It's that we have internalized patriarchy to such an extent. And she says in one line, she says, well, you know, my immigrant heart just wants to do what I'm told, you know, and she feels the pull of that. Sort of second generation kind of trauma of like wanting to fit in. And it's no kind of coincidence that her husband is a white man and she's a Bangladeshi immigrant. And so she just wants to behave in a way, even though she doesn't want to behave. So I think that was, but the thing about, the interesting thing about Asha is that she's a kind of stealth. She's stealthily subjugated by the forces of patriarchy. Mm. She's not obviously. She's very sassy on the outside, but she gives away a lot on the inside.
Yeah, almost, you know, fitting herself into a system that has kind of been allowed to be the way it is. It really clarified for me this thing that I've been thinking about a lot, which is, I guess, you know, certainly on social media, on one of the aforementioned apps, it's very easy to criticize individuals for wrongdoings, but in so doing you often make it about the individual who has done the wrongdoing rather than a system that allows them to operate in the way they do. And you certainly feels like that in the book, where, you know, this, you know, Cyrus is allowed to become the way he is because the system has been set up for him to become, to go that way. Is that something that you've kind of seen, like, experienced firsthand, that kind of the way the system, these sorts of structures allow for this kind of bad behavior, this kind of gaslighting, this kind of sort of entitlement to power?
Absolutely. I mean, I've sat in boardrooms and I've been in investment pitches and I have watched this kind of startup world from an outsider's point of view. But it certainly feels to me like, and I was trying to imagine, like, what if I was a founder of this company? How would I have been treated? And I know for sure that it wouldn't have been the same, because there's just a kind of bro culture that is so deep in the sort of bones of tech and of any industry, really. And so for a woman trying to kind of say, okay, not only am I the brains behind this, but I'm going to stand in front, I'm going to sit at the head of the table. I mean, that is, you know, it feels impossible, even to Asha, who is like, you know, really knows what she wants.
Yeah.
Kind of goes for it.
Does it make you think about what your kids' future relationship with technology will be?
Well, that's a really great question. And I mean, what is your kind of policy on things like apps and screen time? And
I mean, my kids don't have much access to them. You know, I remember someone saying to me once that kids who are just sort of sat in front of things are a lot more passive than kids who you engage in active role play. And my kids really engage in active role play. You know, we read together a lot. We play lots of imagined games where, you know, we act out Legos, but we also like role play other things. And they, so their interest in screens is much more one of curiosity. I mean, they can sit and watch TV for hours. Who can't? But their interest in screens, they get bored really quickly, or they get stuck in a repetitive loop of a thing that they might be doing without any real desire to kind of move beyond it. Like my dad bought them these, Frozen watches. They're like smart watches where you can like take photos and videos and record your voice and stuff, which made me really uncomfortable. But then I sort of knew in my head, give it a day. And like, they ran out of battery and they were handed to me and I charged them up and they haven't asked for them since the day they were given to them. Whereas there's...
That is a parenting win, Nikesh. Yeah. I think that's like, says some great things about your parenting. I have a question though about that. Were your parents strict with you about things like TV when you were growing up?
Oh yeah, very, very strict about TV.
Isn't it? Totally. But don't you find it very interesting? My parents were so strict about TV. My dad was a communist. I mean, material possessions, anything. And when it comes to their grandchildren, that, I mean, I saw that watch and I was like, that is totally something that my parents would get for my kids and I would be the one to ban it. And I would be like, why are you giving this to them? But I remember my childhood when the consumption of things like media and objects was so limited, both by resources because, you know, they didn't have the money to buy me lots of whatever is, but also I remember when I was 10, I asked my dad for a Barbie doll and he was so offended. He said, I will buy you a Barbie doll if you write me a letter explaining exactly why this object has value to you.
Oh, wow.
So I admire it now, but I've just found it so terrible that everyone else had these access to these things that I didn't. But when it comes to their grandchildren, they're just completely, they've totally changed their tune.
Yeah, I mean, my dad is very much the grandparent who lives in a different city to his grandchildren. These are guilt presents. But my kid came back from school yesterday and was talking about how they had their first class in learning to code. And I was like,
wow.
Whoa. You are far too young to be able to hack into the mainframe, my friend. But I suppose...
How old was your child, the one who's learning to code?
She's six. She's six age? And a half. And I was...
Okay, but, so my son is seven. Yeah, same age.
Is that something that he's done as well?
No. And that's kind of amazing. So were you against it? Or how did it make you feel? It felt like it was too soon.
No, I think it's... I guess it's like learning a language, right? Like it will help her see the world in different ways. But I guess I was interested to kind of let it play out and see whether that then means she's much more interested in screens. So we'll see. But what is your... Sorry, I'm so inarticulate today. What is your and your partner's kind of attitude towards tech and your kids? Are they really into it? Do they kind of know that because Bubba is doing it and you know you have an involvement in it that means that they get involved, or are they still a bit...
I mean, basically we are very, very strict on screens. They don't get any screen time. They get to watch movies, and because of the pandemic we started like family movie time on weekends, so that's like a pretty sacred thing. And it means that every, you know, afternoon on a Saturday and a Sunday, we kind of get a break and they just sit in front of the TV and we sort of do our whatever, you know, have a little moment to catch our breath and make dinner and et cetera. But they're not allowed to use apps or iPads or YouTube or anything. It's interesting with your daughter and coding. I feel a little bit like, is my child going to be tech literate enough? Like, is he going to feel like he's missing out because he literally does not really know how to use the iPad? And when we were doing homeschooling, there were other kids who were like chatting, you know, like typing into the group chat and changing screens. And he was a little bit lost. So I'm feeling a bit like maybe we were a bit too strict with that, but it has worked out great because he's a really big reader. And I think that reading is basically the key to all forms of intelligence in the world.
I agree with you so much. What I want to do, because they've got the rest of their lives to be on whatever apps and tablets and computers that they want. But if I can push for reading to be part of their lives for as long as possible, then in theory that will sustain it through the difficult teenage years, which is obviously like the key time to lose readers.
Oh my God, absolutely. I mean, were you a big reader when you were growing up?
Yeah, but mostly because I was a shy, lonely kid. Like me and my superhero comic books. That they were my friends, you know.
Yeah, right. Of course, I've read about that, but I agree. I mean, I think loneliness kind of saved me. I was an only child. My parents would take me to the library every weekend. We would check out books and we would bring them home, and that was basically all I did. I didn't have a lot of friends. I had no siblings, so. But I think it's, you know, it was the key, really, the fact that I was reading. So I hope that in some form, and I know there are so many more distractions in the world today than there were many, many years ago when I was growing up, but I hope that I can give a little bit of that to my children. Mm. The other thing that about my childhood that I have failed to replicate is that my parents, so I didn't grow up in Bangladesh. I was born there, but I didn't grow up there. We moved all over the world, and learning to sing Tagore songs was like a huge part of my childhood. The Bangla teacher would come and the singing teacher would come every weekend, and it was the absolute scourge of my weekend because I just wanted to not do that. And it was always someone who was like half asleep or just really didn't want to be there. You know, someone, if you imagine like, you know, I live in New York City or Paris or something, and it's like a student who's kind of like doing it as a weekend job and is like, oh my God, this 5-year-old or this 7-year-old, like, why am I here? And I hated it too. I wish I had done that with my kids, and I completely failed. I completely failed on Bangla. I completely failed on the singing. So it's a real stain on my parental reputation.
Well, you know, I think I've told this story on the podcast before. Sorry, listeners, but that I had such grand plans to make my kids bilingual. And I read books about teaching them to be bilingual. But then the realization of how hard it was really struck me, because in order to do it, you have to talk to them in, you know, in my case, Gujarati all the time. And you have to reply to, it has to be the language of the home. And to the point where my partner, who doesn't speak Gujarati, would just have to kind of know the gist of what we're talking about enough in order to reply in English or what have you. I'm not that good. Like, I haven't spoken Gujarati properly in like 10 years since I moved out of London, and therefore like was seeing my grandparents and aunts and uncles regularly, you know.
But do you feel guilty about it? I mean, is it something that really bothers you?
Yeah, completely. Yeah. It feels like a personal failure. How about you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so I think the mixed race thing is really kind of key here. You know, my partner is white, and he would love to learn Bangla, but I have to be the one to speak Bangla to him and to the children. And what happened was, so our son was born severely premature, and then he had a very serious eating disorder, which meant that he could not eat solid food until he was 5 years old. And the only reason he now eats solid food is we took him to a hospital in New York that was specialized in pediatric feeding disorders, and they taught him how to chew food. And his entire infancy and childhood was consumed with us trying to figure out how to keep him alive. Literally give him enough calories so he would stay alive and not be very, very ill. And I was too tired to teach him another language. I was too tired to speak to him in Bangla. It was exhausting for me. And I also was a little bit traumatized by all the Bangla that was really, you know, Bengalis are obsessed with their language, as you know. And I remember coming home from school and my dad refusing to speak to me unless I narrated the whole story of my day to him in Bangla. So I think that those two things just made it really difficult for me, but I feel incredibly, I feel like I've taken something from them. Like, they could have been totally bilingual. I have this friend whose husband is British. She's Bangladeshi. Her parents are fluent in Bangla because she spoke to them in Bangla, but her husband spoke to them in Chinese, and so they also speak fluent Chinese.
Oh, man.
And I just feel like, oh my God, I am the worst parent in the world. My kids don't even speak Bangla, much less Chinese. Can you imagine?
Yeah, but
so anyway,
you know how much time they spend on tablets when our kids are reading comic books. So who's the real winner?
Some things gotta get.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. You've mentioned it a couple of times, but I sort of feel like it's always an interesting thing to delve into. I guess when we think about ourselves as parents, we look at the things that worked with our parents and the things that we want to be in opposition to with our parents. Are there certain things that you take from your parents as like good practice that worked on you, and are there things that you're like, I'm doing the opposite of that, my friend, because
yeah, that's a really great question. So I have incredible parents. I mean, I one of the things, speaking of the startup wife and speaking of parenting and children, unlike a lot of South Asian parents of that generation, they had a love marriage, not an arranged marriage, and they have very much kept that sort of powerful connection between them. So I grew up in a household where the adults really loved each other. And the other amazing thing about them is that they really encouraged me to become a writer. So I didn't get the message like, oh, you must be an engineer or get a job or do something practical. They were super supportive of me becoming a writer. And it's partly because my father is a journalist and his father before him was a short story writer and a journalist. So I feel incredibly privileged to have been brought up in a household where the arts were valued. Mm. Not all the arts. Like, I wanted to be an actress, and my dad was like, that's really impractical. You should be a writer. This was what he said to me. But
I thought you were going to be like, you know, the arts were really appreciated in my house. Not all the arts. They hate contemporary interpretive dance.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know if they would... I didn't even bring that up, you know, because I was a pretty obedient child, and being an actress is probably as far as... I'm sorry about the horn outside, if you can hear that. I was a pretty obedient child. So the thing that I would not carry with me, and I'm sort of in two minds about this. I wonder how you feel about this. I was terrified of my dad. You know, I found him totally scary. And my kids are not afraid of their father, and I think that's a really great gift. Having said that, I think I sometimes, my South Asian parenting mode kicks in and I think, oh my God, these children are so disobedient. Can you imagine what they're going to be like when they're teenagers? Part of the reason that I stayed in my room and read books was because I was afraid of my dad. So these kids are just going to be like, we're just going to do what we want, mom, because you did not scare us enough. Yeah, I mean, I think they feel completely at ease with saying no to me. And I think, I hope that this will mean that we just have a much more open and honest relationship, that we can talk about things that I didn't feel I could talk about with my parents. That's definitely something that I happily shed from a sort of, you know, earlier generation of parenting.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You know, my father was always the authoritarian, the silent authoritarian in the corner for a large portion of my life. And, you know, part of the memoir is about me reevaluating that as an adult and coming towards him. But I never wanted my kids to ever think I was either A, infallible, or B, the authoritarian. But I do find myself on a daily basis saying, if I spoke to my parents the way you guys speak to me, or if my parents knew how you spoke to me, they'd be outraged.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I think it's so interesting that giving them that freedom to be rebellious or to challenge you, while also feeling like, gosh, where is this gonna end? Where is this going? Yeah. And we both have younger children, so we don't have teenagers yet. We don't know ultimately where that story goes. We're going to have to catch up every few years and be like, how's that disobedience working out for you? How's that vulnerability working out for you? How's the infallibility doing?
It's a funny thing because, and I'd be really interested to hear what you think of this. You know, part of giving them the agency to say no to things that they don't want to happen is obviously a great life lesson, especially for two girls who, you know, and I don't want to be the one who's like, well, actually, your no doesn't actually mean anything in this situation. But there are times where I have to be like, I don't care if you don't want to go to the shops to get some bread. We have to get some bread. You're coming. Which is, it's like, it's an interesting thing because, like, in their world, the yes and the no are so finite. There's no grey. That, you know, everything's so black and white. And so I do sort of feel hoist by the petard of, like, wanting them to feel like they have agency in decision-making when it comes to stuff to do with them.
I know, that's so interesting. I mean, I feel the same way, especially about my daughter. So I really delight in her sort of standing her ground and being quite stubborn and oftentimes quite difficult. But then I also have to parent her, and I also have to get her from point A to point B, and I have to make sure she eats and that she, you know, that she does the sort of basic kind of life things. And it's always that kind of juggle between that sort of impulse to be the sort of civilizing force in your children, while also, especially for your daughters, knowing that the more determined and bullheaded they are, the better they're going to do in life because the cards are really stacked against them. I'm completely on the same page with you on that. And we're just going to have to see what happens.
Yeah, really, I suppose it does result in having to explain, spend a lot of time explaining why things have to be the way they are, which is, I suppose, a good thing, because as a child, it was never really explained to me why things had to be the way they are. Why do I have to go to this person who's like a fake uncle's house and sit there where I could just stay here and watch football or stay here and listen to rap on dad's stereo instead of on my Walkman?
What do you think about that whole uncle thing? I mean, so I have some really deep thoughts about uncle culture, most of it bad. But I remember spending a lot more time in the company of adults than my children do. So I will bend over backwards to make play dates and make sure they're entertained and do things that are appropriate for them. My parents just took me with them everywhere. You know, because there wasn't like, we didn't grow up in South Asia where there's always a, you know, family member to kind of watch the kids. We lived in Paris, or we lived in tiny apartments in New York. And it was like, well, if we want to go somewhere, our kid's just going to have to come with us. And I think that must have, in a way, been a good thing because, you know, you get to sort of inhabit this world that's slightly beyond you. But I don't know if that was the case for you. I mean, if you sort of remember being dragged to, you know, lots of uncles' houses as I did.
Yeah, until I was a teenager, at which point everyone, you know, all of my young my sister and cousins all just stayed with me, and I was the babysitter every weekend while my parents worked and all the rest of it. So like, so I spent a large portion of my childhood like looking after people. I hate being a stereotyper, but was that an only child thing where you felt like you were in the company of adults quite a lot?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my parents, and it's interesting how this sort of slightly then echoed in my own life. So my parents had me, they were quite young, and then they couldn't have children, and they tried for many, many years. And then they accidentally, my mother got pregnant with my sister when I was 13. So I was already fully grown. I was a teenager. So my main abiding memories of childhood are of being alone and of being, and of reading, basically, alone. Obviously, like the best writers, I was not good at making friends. I was not good at fitting in school. I was too weird. And, you know, I don't know if you feel this way, Nikesh, but you're a few years younger than me, but it's only in the last few years that I've really come to peace with the kind of friendships that feel nourishing to me. Because when you're in school, my husband was homeschooled and I think was saved. He doesn't have a lot of high school trauma. But in school, you just are expected to socialize in a particular way. And I was really, really bad at it. And now I know why. But I just didn't figure that out until really recently. And it's been a hugely satisfying kind of revelation to me.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same way. I don't really feel like I made any lasting friendships until I was in my 20s. And even then, that none of them were with people I went to university with. They were all people outside of university. Mm. But it's an interesting thing. I think all of my most nourishing friendships at now are with other writers who have the same weirdness that I have. And we know when to step back and give each other space, and we know when to lean in.
Yeah.
My last sort of regular question before I flip to the ones that I ask all of my guests are, do you, you know, given that your partner is a tech startup entrepreneur, CEO, I don't know his job title, sorry.
Yes,
and you
things.
Are a writer, how much awareness of what you guys do your kids have? Do they know what you do, is it also such a mystery to them? Because I think for my kids, my eldest is starting to understand that I am a writer with a little bit of a public profile, because very occasionally like weird things will happen, like a random person will come up and just say, oh, I really like your books, and she'll be like, who's that? And I'll be like, I have no idea. Or, you know, especially in lockdown, she's seen that like loads of free books come to our house. They don't go to my office anymore and all that kind of stuff. So she's starting to kind of go, this guy isn't like, is very different to the other fathers in my school, which I'm kind of intrigued by.
Yes. Well, I don't think my children have a full understanding of, I think if I wrote children's books, they would be way more impressed. I recently told my son that I know the children's book writer Alam Shaha, who, if you don't have his books, you should definitely get them. He writes books about inventions, right? And about scientific. Yeah, amazing. And I said, I just got a message from Alam Shaha. And my son was like, oh my God, you know him? You know, so that's really impressive. But they're super into their dad being an inventor. Mm. And the reason is that the product that he makes is a light up keyboard that teaches you how to play piano, and they've been using it to learn to play piano, especially during lockdown. So I mean, they're like so much more impressed with him than with me, but you know, I'll get there. I'll sneak in there at some point, you know, maybe someone will recognize me or something will happen. Hold on one second, Nikesh, because someone's trying to call me and I just want to make sure that our recording is not being interrupted. I don't know how to make it go away. Oh, it's still going. It's all good. Okay, sorry about that. But yes, not impressed with me, very impressed with their dad. I'm just going to have to suck it up and hope that at some point, you know, they'll read my books
How do you feel about them reading your books? I mean, obviously the first three deal with, you know, loads of really hard-hitting political stuff. And this is kind of, you know, this is a really, like, a brilliant satire about like the last bunch of years of your life. Not your life. It's very easy for people to project onto you, like Usher, because of
absolutely, sort of... yeah. And there's totally, and I mean, I didn't have the guts to write a memoir like you did, and I completely respect that so much. And I know how. I mean, I can't imagine how much you must feel like your heart is just out there in the world, and they're gonna someday read that. But there are lots of very personal articles. I wrote a piece in The Guardian about my son's eating disorder, and I definitely read it thinking someday he's going to read this. I mean, I wrote it thinking someday he's going to read this, and just wanting to make sure that that was not going to be too much of a difficult experience for him. My friend's 10-year-old daughter read The Startup Wife. So she sent me a picture saying my daughter's reading it, and I was like, you know, there's a lot of sex in the book, right? And there's also like, there's sex, there's, you know, startups that talk about sex, there's a startup that makes vibrators. I mean, there's a lot in there. And she was like, yeah, you know, my daughter's really, we've been talking about it all the way through. I definitely don't think my children will be ready by the time they're 10, certainly not my son. So I'm going to try to have to hide it from them till they're teenagers. And then just, yeah, hopefully keep enough of an open dialogue so that they can be reading and talking, asking me questions at the same time. How do you feel about Brown Baby, and when you feel like your kids, because there's so much there about your mother and your grief and raising them. I mean, it's like deeply, deeply personal, and it's nonfiction, so there's just that much more exposure.
I don't know if they'll ever need to read it. Like, if I raise them in the way that I want them to be, then all of the stuff that's in there, wow, they will already just know. And also, I think part of them would just be horrified and cringe at the whole thing anyway. I really remember I've used this example as well, but I remember my ex-girlfriend was roommates at college with, she was American, with the daughter of a really great piece of American literature, which I'll tell you the name of offline. And when I was like, oh my god, that's your dad, you know, when I was like 20, I was, yeah, like, oh my god, a writer, this is what I want to do at some point. And she was just like, oh yeah, it's really embarrassing. And I when someone asked me in an interview, I remembered that moment. I was like, that's probably how they'll react, you know.
I think it's good because they see you, yeah, as a person first, and as the figure, the public figure, yeah, second. So that's probably the right
I'm working on a children's book at the moment, which they're very excited about. And when I was telling them about it, and I was sort of expressing like, oh, it's quite hard to do this and this and this, my daughter just described, she said, you should include this character that is X, Y, and Z. And it was such a perfect description. I was like, well, that's now the villain of the piece. So that was really cool.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really
amazing.
Lovely.
Yeah. That's incredible.
Okay, so the reason I wrote the book and the reason I started the podcast is because there's one question at the heart of them that I always try and ask my guests, because it's just like an ongoing bit of inquiry for me. The thing that keeps me up at night is, how on earth do we raise our kids to be joyful and boundless in a world that is so bleak and fucked? And I personally feel so sad and angry all the time staring at the news. And I wondered how you manage that, how you get through those days, and how that affects how you are as a parent. I keep knocking this.
That is such a great question. I always love that question at the end of your podcast, and people have answered it more intelligently than I can. I mean, I think the question for me really is, how do we talk about injustice? You know, I think that it is so essential for our children to understand that the world is fundamentally unfair. And that the reason that their lives are not unfair is because they live lives of enormous privilege. And so I think but obviously we want them to experience joy and not be completely swallowed and swamped by that sense of the knowledge that they are part of a system that, you know, creates suffering for others while it creates joy for them. So I don't know if I'm answering that well, but I think conversations about injustice are absolutely essential, and conversations about privilege. And then I think on the other hand, giving our children joy is so damn easy for us. We can buy them whatever they want. We can give them security. They have a roof over their head. I mean, I feel like I feel the opposite. I feel like I want to give them a little taste or a little understanding of what life is like for everybody else. So it's just trying to strike that balance, really.
That's amazing. I think that's the first time, that's the first, you're the first person who's phrased it like that. And I think that is so important. Like, you're right, that the sort of leaning into thinking about ensuring that they know that they're okay, like they're aware in a way that makes sense to them in the world. You know, quite often whenever I've talked to them about things like racism and sexism, I've found bringing myself into the conversation and like everything that I've sort of witnessed or experienced and or even done in some cases. And I have to always remember to kind of take myself out of the conversation and just sort of try and see the world through their eyes. And it is okay to present a binary world where racism is really bad and fucked and sexism is really bad and fucked and none of them make sense, and yet they exist very prevalently.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a beautiful way of putting it. It's because they think in such black and white terms. And they would say to you, well, if it's unfair, then why does it exist? And that's the really hard thing to try to explain, is that something that is deeply fucked up is actually an essential part of the way the world works. How that happened and why, it's, that's very, very confusing for them.
How do you essentially tell children, people are bad. People are bad people. Okay, so finally, what is the best advice you've been given as a parent, and what's the most useless advice you've been given as a parent? Bonus points if it's the same bit of advice. But...
Oh my god! So the best piece of advice is actually a really, really small thing, which was somebody told me to put my children to bed at 7 o'clock at night. And it has saved my sanity, it has saved my marriage, it has saved, you know, like, because I grew up in a South Asian culture where the children just don't go to bed. They stay awake the whole time and they're always awake when you're awake. And I think having a few hours of the day when I'm awake and my children are asleep has been really essential to the preservation of myself as an individual. Whereas at all other hours of the day, I'm present as a parent as well as an individual. So that was a great piece of advice. However, it's also quite useless because sometimes you just have to be flexible. And I really, in the first 5 years of parenting, was super uptight about 7 o'clock bedtime. I drove everyone crazy. And looking back, maybe I should have just chilled out and been like, hey, it's okay if it's, you know, late. So I think the thing with parenting is you kind of have to learn to roll with the punches and, not try to exert too much control. Which is hard for me. I'm a bit of a control freak.
Thank you so much for coming on the Brown Baby Podcast.
Thank you, Nikesh. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for sharing the space with me.
Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Acast. Thank you to Tamima. Thank you to Canongate, her publisher. Thank you to my publisher, Bluebird. Thank you to all of you listeners. Thank you to all of the listeners who listen to this in years to come. Thank you to all of you. Just thank you. Just thank you. But mostly, thank you to the food truck last week that sold me a hopper with Nutella and banana. And I ate it looking out across the bay of the north coast of Devon. Thank you. You helped me find my happy place. See you next week, everyone. Goodbye.
Goodbye, my brown babies. Goodbye, my brown babies.
I love you, my brown babies, so much.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.